Jessica Edith Louise Foster, Jessie to the people who loved her most, was a 21-year-old from Kamloops, British Columbia. Her family thought she was living the good life in Las Vegas. On the evening of March 28, 2006, Jessie talked to her sister in Canada, who was planning to come visit Jessie in a few weeks. After that conversation, Jessie was never heard from again. I'm Ed Dentzel, and this is Unfound. Have any of you ever watched the David Foster Wallace commencement speech that he gave to Kenyon College in 2005? It's called This Is Water. It's a speech about having compassion for others. Are we well adjusted? It's a talk about how we all tend to get caught up in our own stuff. He gives the example of seeing a person driving a Hummer. What's the automatic thought? Why does that person need a car that large? Why couldn't that person have bought something smaller? We never consider that the reason that person bought that huge vehicle is because the driver was in a horrible car accident 20 years ago. That getting out on the public roads is one of the worst fears this person ever goes through in his life. It's amazing how we get caught up in our own stuff. I bring this up because in March 2006, I worked for a magic show as a stage manager. I was a stage manager for a Rat Pack show. I was also a printer repairman. Yes, really. I had sore feet, a sore back, no days off, dealing with cranky magicians, singers who were excellent divas, and customers who wanted their machines fixed yesterday. Yes, it was a little rough. This was all going on for me when I lived in Las Vegas. All the while, most likely, Jessie Foster was scared for her life. Forced into prostitution. She'd suffered a broken jaw the year before. Many run-ins with the law. Probably putting up with all of it because she was afraid of what her pimp, her sex trafficker, might do to her family back in Canada. And then one day in late March 2006, I'm sure I had something to complain about. She disappeared just a few miles from where I worked. And she disappeared most likely against her will. It's horrible how we all get caught up in our own stuff. I wonder if I ever met her. I wonder if I ever saw her in one of the casinos sitting at the bar. And I will tell you that I saw quite a few working girls in my day in Las Vegas. No, I never paid for one or anything like that. I'm not that type of guy. But I can tell you this. In all those years, I lived in Las Vegas over 13 years, seeing all of the prostitutes that I did. I don't think I ever once considered that they were out there by force. Just being honest. Once again, it's amazing how we all get caught up in our own stuff. I wonder if I could go back to that time and think about what I had going on in 2005, 2006, and just coincidentally find Jessie Foster in my memory, maybe just a glance, maybe just a few seconds going through a casino somewhere. What did I think? Once again, I don't know how much compassion I would have had for her. I wonder what I would have done had she come up to me and said, I can't go home tonight because I'm afraid my boyfriend would beat me up. Can you help me out? And I'll be honest that I probably would have said, well, maybe you should go to the police. Not a terrible answer, but really, it would be an answer that would allow me to extricate myself in the quickest way possible. And that's my fault, not hers. Once again, it's amazing how we get caught up in our own stuff. I can't go back to 2005, 2006 in Las Vegas, where I could maybe search Jessie out and get her out of the situation that she was in. No time travel machines exist. But maybe bringing attention to her disappearance in March of 2006 can in some way make up for my lack of compassion back then because of me being too caught up in my own stuff. This episode is called Jessie Foster, Gone in the 702. Jessie Foster was last contacted by a family member while at her residence in North Las Vegas on March 28, 2006. Her live-in boyfriend, reached several days later, claimed that she left on April 3rd, taking all of her belongings except her makeup and her hairdryer. Jessie was convicted of prostitution multiple times in Las Vegas between June 2005 and March 2006. Her family was unaware of her lifestyle until she disappeared. She kept in daily contact with her relatives in Canada and had planned to attend her sister's wedding reception in April, but Jessie disappeared before this could happen. Jessie has not used her bank card, bank account, or cell phone since March 28, 2006. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Jessie Foster, please contact the North Las Vegas Police Department at 702-633-1773 or the Kamloops British Columbian Police in Canada at 250-828-3293. What you're about to hear is an interview I conducted with Glendine Grant, Jessie's mother, on September 23rd, 2016. I should tell you, Glendine, who I've gotten to know very well within the last month, she doesn't need much prodding about what she wants to talk about. She has a lot of passion. And that's what I've enjoyed about getting to know her so well. She's very clear on what she believes happened to her daughter. She also wants everyone to know that Jessie did not pick the life that she got, that she was sex trafficked into it. I think this interview is also a very good example of my attitude on this show, that I am not the star of the show. I am simply a vessel. The show is a vessel for other people to tell their stories. So in this interview, you're not going to hear me talk very much. I just let Glendine tell the story because she is the one who knows the most about it and has been emotionally been affected, of course, the most by it. I give you Glendine Grant. On the phone, I'm so fortunate to have the mother of Jessie Foster. Her name is Glendine Grant. Glendine, please introduce yourself. I really appreciate you talking to me.
Oh, I appreciate that you have me on. As you say, my name is Glendine Grant. I'm the mother of four daughters. I have four grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
I've been married to my husband now for 30 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I had two children when we met. Jessie is my second oldest. When Jessie was 21 years old in 2006, she was, we reported missing. We reported her missing out of Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
She had been taken there in 2005, and we didn't know, but, you know, some horrible things had happened to her, and by the time she was reported missing, it was, we knew that she was a victim of human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, coming from a family as ours, as normal as you could be, you know, we're even lower than middle income. We're, you know, we got by very well, you know, as far as putting our children into guides and, you know, summer camps and mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we, you know, didn't have any extras, and the kids knew that. And they grew up knowing how to be modest and frugal. And at age 16, Jesse had asked, first she asked me and my husband, her stepdad, Jim, if we would mind if she chose to move to Calgary to live with her dad and stepmom for her grade 11 and then perhaps grade 12.
Was that a surprise?
You know, it was more of a no, don't go kind of a thing, but not really a surprise. Jesse was always close with her dad and always close with her stepmom and stepsisters.
Mm-hmm.
And her and Krista spent, you know, summers, you know, in Calgary with them or meeting them out at a lake in the Shuswap here in B.C. And, you know, it was no surprise to me that she wanted to. Her reasoning actually was very well thought, I thought anyways. She said, if I go for grade 11 and I like it, then I can stay in Calgary and graduate for grade 12. But if I don't really like it, I can come back to Kamloops and graduate with the same kids that I went, you know, through with my whole school life with in Kamloops. And I thought, well, that, you know, that's pretty smart thinking. No, I mean, if she doesn't like Calgary, she won't have to graduate there and then have that as her, you know, her memory for the rest of her life. So she left in grade 11 there and loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse always had a little bit more flair after she became a teenager. Before a teenager, she was a tomboy, but after she became a teenager, you know, she learned about hair and makeup and such and got braces and you know, very, very attractive young lady and always kind of liked the city life a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And
sounds a little bit like my sounds a little bit like myself. I grew up in the country and ended up in the city. Sure.
And yeah. You know, my husband grew up on a farm.
Huh.
And I grew up in Kamloops, which at the time probably had 70,000 people. Now has probably 90,000, 95,000. And it's big enough that there are things for children to do without getting bored or, you know, getting into too much trouble. Yet it's small enough to keep track of your kids and, you know, to have a nice community. It's, mm-hmm. you don't have to live in one section of the city and pretty well be stuck in there doing everything because everything else is so far away. And so I'm happy that, you know, Kamloops is where I was raised. And
yeah.
All my other kids prefer it here, my other three, and two of them have children now. One of them, my third daughter, has a little boy who's 7, and my youngest daughter has 3 little girls, ages 8, 6, and 4, and they love it in Kamloops, too. So, you know, my oldest daughter has worked and traveled and lived in different places, but she has her children, so this is something that she chooses to do. And so when Jesse graduated in Calgary, she stayed on afterwards. And,
what did she do in high school? What did she have hobbies in high school? Was she in any clubs or anything like that? What did she do in high school?
She did a lot, actually. Well, what she did all through her life was she did the brownies and the guides and the swimming lessons and all the community things.
Mm-hmm.
And then as she got a bit older, she started getting into different types of dance lessons, like jazz and hip-hop and things.
Mm-hmm.
So dance and also sports were Jesse's things that I think were chosen. I mean, when she's been on the front page of the newspaper, halfway through her high jump, that she won the first place ribbon in you know, grade 7 in the sport meet. And, mm-hmm. you know, she's always been something that she's, that's interested her. And she's, if she didn't get on the achievement honor roll each year, she would at least get on the effort honor roll because, you know, she always did her very best in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Many times her very best got her the right marks, and sometimes her very best didn't. But you can also be on an honor roll for your effort, and that was something that, you know, I always told her I was even prouder for the effort honor roll because it showed that she tried her hardest. Some people can get on an honor roll simply by opening a book and writing a test. They don't have to study and put effort into it because it just comes so easy. If it doesn't come easy for you, the effort is very admirable. So, you know, she loved her, you know, school. Was always very popular and active with her schoolmates. At Kamloops, she went to kindergarten all through elementary school, junior high, and the beginning of high school with some of the same kids. Because Kamloops is that small. And then when and some of those same, that I still call kids, are now in their early to mid-30s, married, have children, and they still keep in touch with me. They still love and are concerned about Jesse, and those things will never change.
It'll
be in their heart forever.
Yeah.
But she also has a whole other set of friends from Calgary who only knew her for a couple of years and absolutely loved her just as much also. And I know this because in 2012, I was invited to Jesse's 10-year high school reunion. I was contacted by the president of the person that was of the organization when they as they were getting it ready, and they said, you know, this is really touching. They go, Jesse has always been in all of our hearts. When none of us could believe it when she went missing, and we think about her all the time, and we miss her. And we would like to honor her by inviting you to her 10-year high school reunion.
Wow.
And this is in Calgary. And they said, you know, you and your husband, if you'd like to. And I said, well, you know, my husband wouldn't be able to come. But I would like to bring her stepmom, Tracy, who actually lives in Calgary and who Jesse lived with while she went to high school. And they said, that's wonderful. And her and I get along very well. So I went to Calgary. I actually stayed with them, and we went to her 10-year high school reunion.
That's 2012.
In 2012, okay. Exactly, yes. They opened a time capsule that they do every year, that they had put away in 2002, and they had some letters and some things of Jesse's that she had put in there on her grad year. And it was wonderful. It was amazing. And to see the love from all of these students, they are now, you know, young men and women who you can tell adored Jesse, loved her, and just wanted the answers that all of us did, you know.
Yeah.
I felt that I was connected to a whole other part of her life that was really, you know, it was really just her dad and her stepmom were connected because these kids didn't come home after school to my house. I never got to know any of them. You know,
right.
I met a few of them on Jesse's grad, but that's different. When you go to another city for your child's grad, it's not like you meet and remember all the kids that she's, you know, gone to school with. And let me tell you, Calgary is a large city, over a million people, and the high school had well over 1,500 students graduating.
Wow.
You know, the high school that Jesse would have graduated from here in Kamloops, probably he didn't even have that many students in the entire school, let alone grade 12. So very large class of graduating students that year. So after Jesse graduated, she stayed on in Calgary. She got two jobs and worked her butt off while she was deciding what she wanted to go to college for.
What jobs did she have? What'd she do?
She worked at Ticketmaster.
Huh.
It was kind of like her day kind of office job, but it was more like a call center where people would call in to order tickets for concerts or football games, hockey games, things like that.
Yeah.
And she also worked at Boston Pizza. She worked there with her stepsister, actually. And then after that, she worked at she always kept her Ticketmaster until they actually closed that office down. But we always laugh because then she got a job at at Thrifty's jean store because she said she needed to build up her jeans wardrobe by, you know, spending most of her wages on jeans. And then after that, she got a job at Reitman, she said, so she could get some nice dressy clothes and summer clothes. And it was so funny because she dressed to the nines always.
She's just killing two birds with one stone. That's all she was doing there.
Right. You know, she had a full-time job to pay the bills and a part-time job to pay for the clothes.
Yes.
And then after that, just before she left Calgary, she had gone back to waitressing again and was working at Jameson's Pub. Which she always liked because when you're young and you are good at waitressing, the tips can really, really make a difference in how much money you make. And it's a social thing and it's a fun thing. And excuse me. And so that's what she was doing. Then in 2005, in March, she decided that she was going to come back to Kamloops. She wasn't sure exactly if she wanted to stay in Kamloops and go to Thompson Rivers University, or she was going to go back to Calgary and maybe go to Mount Royal College, which is now Mount Royal University, or what. She was still iffy about what she wanted to take in her schooling.
Mm-hmm.
She had almost $20,000 in the bank.
Wow.
Because when she was in grade 11, she was hit by a car that had ran a red light and hit her in a crosswalk on her way to school. So at age 19, she got a $24,000 settlement, and she had bought a car and some furniture and still had many thousand dollars. I mean, still there when she went missing, still there to this day, that money is. It's never been touched. But the money, she had earmarked it for her education. She just had to decide what she wanted to do.
How badly was she injured in this accident? That sounds like something that's pretty serious.
Well, I think most of the money came because the guy ran a red light and hit a kid in a crosswalk in front of the school. I think more than how she, but you know what? She never played sports, and she had pretty much a chronic leg injury.
Huh.
For many years after that. So it was serious. Yes, it was.
Okay.
And, you know, the trauma, you know, like you're 16 years old and you're flying through the air after you get hit by a car, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons why it was such a large amount. And she obviously had a good lawyer. Her dad helped her with all that stuff. So, you know.
Good.
So her plan was, you know, I don't know if I'm going to go to school here. I don't know if I'm going to go to school there. I don't know if I want to be a lawyer. I don't know if I want to be, hairdresser and makeup artist to the stars, because trust me, she could have been. She was so good at those things. And so she decided to come back to Kamloops. She actually took her furniture. She had all of her furniture because she had purchased this stuff when she got that settlement. She put it into a storage unit. And basically just brought her clothing and her car and came to Kamloops. And she was there for a while, long enough that she ended up having two jobs there. She was working during the day out at the Kamloops Golf and Country Club and a part-time evening and weekend job at the Kamloops Boston Pizza. And one thing that she had a lot of experience working at Boston Pizza's, because when she applied here and they called up the Boston Pizza in Calgary she'd worked at for a couple of years, they hired her on the spot pretty well. So she had both of those jobs. And
mm-hmm.
So what had happened was...
How did she run into Donald Voss?
Let's see, something happened here to my phone.
I can still hear you.
Okay, good. Now, how she had met Donald Vaz was she was 17 years old. She was living in Calgary. She was dating a young man named John who was a DJ. And what he would do for with his music is he would put on hip-hop shows. Different areas of the city and different people could attend. Something like that in Kamloops, there would be one and it would be in an area, and every kid in the whole city could attend. Mm-hmm. But in Calgary, like, he would have one in all the different areas of the city, and the kids from those areas would go. And Donald Bass started attending these hip-hop shows. And as I had told you before, Jesse had actually even taken hip-hop dance lessons. So when her boyfriend was a DJ and she was dancing, and, you know, it was so much fun. And, you know, they just became very popular. Jesse especially, because she's a beautiful young lady.
Mm-hmm.
And he became her friend. She met him at age 17. And when Jesse came back to Kamloops, she was 20. So if you think of it as a 17, now 20-year-old young woman,
yeah,
you would think, oh, I know this guy. I've known him for 3 years. I know him. So when he invited her to go on a trip, I told her, you can't go on a trip, you know, like you don't know him and all this stuff. And she says, oh, I do know him, Mom. You know, I've known him for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so she goes on a trip.
And this was after she wasn't boyfriend-girlfriend with John anymore? This was well after that?
Well, this is after she had moved to Kamloops.
Okay.
Back to Kamloops.
Okay.
So what had happened was it was more or less he was her friend, not calling her as a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He was a friend. I'm going to go on a trip, and I want you to come. And
Donald. Go with Donald on a trip.
Yeah, and she's like, I've known him 3 years. I know him. I'm going to go. And so that's how that happened.
So Jesse plans to go with Donald Voss on a trip. Where are they going to go?
Florida.
And,
He says to go visit his mother.
Okay.
Turns out she didn't live in Florida, but we didn't know that until much later.
Hmm.
So what she does is she goes on this trip against my, not only against my wishes, but it was my, I dreaded it.
Yeah.
Come back, and I'm like, oh, okay.
How long was she gone? How long did she go?
4 days.
4 days. Okay.
3 days there, and then a day of travel. So basically, it was 4 days the whole trip. Well, what happened was she shows us all these pictures. She's water parasailing. She's out on the, jumping on water trampolines in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and all these big boats. Like, isn't that wonderful? I mean, if I hadn't have been so concerned about her the whole time, I probably would have been jealous.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
That's how wonderful it looked.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, you know, Mom was wrong, but, you know, keep in mind that, you know, this stuff happens. Well, a week or so, you know, maybe 10 days go by, and Mom, Don asked me if I wanted to go on another trip with him. This time to Manhattan and to Atlantic City, New Jersey. And I'm like, what?
Hmm.
I said, what does he want? He doesn't want anything. I said, well, either he wants you as a girlfriend or he wants something. Oh, Mom, you know, you're dramatic and all this stuff. And yeah, sure, I am dramatic. But you know what? I'm also a mom of all girls. And you've got to kind of, I don't know, I always kind of perceive, you know, the worst so that nothing ever is disappoints you. It's always like, oh, thank God, everything's wonderful, you know.
Yeah.
And that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, me saying that, but, you know, just to give you an idea, yeah, you do have to be a bit dramatic with your kids. You do have to give them pause to think, you know?
Yeah.
And if I said, yeah, might not be safe going there, that's not going to give her pause to, you know, think. If I go, oh, my God, Jesse, he wants something, nothing for free. What is his ulterior motive? You know, that might give her a reason to think about what I'm saying. You know, so that is why I, at least as a mom, do kind of a little bit of a more dramatic flair.
But you weren't. But let's be clear. You weren't worried that he was hurting her or anything. You were just concerned about just the average kind of relationship stuff.
Okay. Well, here's me watching way too much Law and Order, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't worry that Jesse would be beaten and trafficked into prostitution.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, what does he want? Like, for one, if he just wanted to, I hate sounding, saying this, like, if this, because this is my daughter, but just to be blunt, I mean, if he just wanted to get into her pants.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work, right?
Yeah.
You know? So I'm like, okay, it can't be just, you know, that. You know, I mean, because he can take her to a nightclub, or you know what I mean, wine on diamond. You don't have to take her all the way across the country and down across into the United States. So,
right.
So I'm like, okay, it's not, you know, something like that. So if he's trying to oppress her, is my daughter, you know, that hard to get as a girlfriend? Like, is this his way of showing her what a wonderful boyfriend he would make? You know, so
yeah.
I'm trying to think of it that way. But that didn't make sense either, because Jesse never went through the boyfriend. Like, she was really picky. Like, she had, in Kamloops, in high school, she had one boyfriend through high school. And when that ended, she didn't have another boyfriend. I mean, I was going through notes of hers, like, just a couple weeks ago. I organized everything in my house, including all the stuff I had in boxes, and I came across Jesse's box of school stuff, and I started reading, and I felt guilty. Half of her life has gone by,
yeah.
And I felt guilty reading the notes that her and her girlfriends exchanged in grade 10 high school. And some of them were, you know, all that sad about you and Ryan breaking up and things like this, right? So it was a very important relationship to her, and she didn't have... where everybody's like, oh, Jesse, he likes so-and-so. And after that relationship, she did not, you know, suddenly have another boyfriend. And when she was in Calgary, she dated John. But by the time she graduated, they were not together anymore. And the young man that she went to grad with was just another young man who was graduating. It wasn't a, you know, significant boyfriend. It probably was really hard to capture her heart, you know?
Did you ever meet Donald Voss? Did he ever come to the house?
No, because he lives in Alberta, and that's where she lived when she lived with her dad.
Did that also concern you, that he was taken to these places but never came over to the house?
No, because, well, for one, by the time we even knew who he was, Jesse was already missing. We didn't really know who... I don't...
Oh.
She went missing. I couldn't even remember this guy's name that took her. Like, cause to me, I could say it was all drama. I was trying to make her.
So she's going on. So just to be clear for the listeners, she's going on these trips, but you're not even sure who this guy is.
No, and I'll tell you why. Okay.
Okay.
I knew that.
That is not. By the way, that is not a criticism. Just trying to. Just
no,
make just to clear.
I didn't think you did, but I want people to understand, you know, why. You know, why is it? Why did he like more? Like, I gave her my opinions. I told her I didn't like it. I, you know, told her she shouldn't go, and I made myself very clear as to how I felt. But I'm not like, I want his name, I want his number, and what's his mother's address, and everything like that, simply because she was a 20-year-old high school graduate who had lived in her own apartment for 2 years prior.
Yeah.
Without a mom and a dad telling her what to do.
Yeah, 20 years old. What are you going to do?
I didn't feel like I wasn't worried about something happening to her, so I didn't think I needed to have all of his contact information just in case. You know, I knew that, you know. More or less, I'm like, what does he want? What does he want? Why is he doing this? Why is he doing this? You know, it wasn't that I thought anything was going to happen to him.
Right. But she did end up taking the second trip, and they ended up going to New York City, right?
That's right. No, they went to Manhattan, and they went to Atlantic City, and a couple of days, that's all. And then I get a phone call from her the night before they're supposed to come back. But they already had the tickets. It was a return flight. So I get a call. And Jesse says to me, oh, Mom, I'm in the lobby of our hotel. I'm lost all the cash that he had in Atlantic City. Now we don't have any cash for our trip home, you know, for food, for a taxi, for anything. So he said to me, well, maybe you can do a couple of trips and you can get us some money to get us home. And she storms out of the room, goes to the lobby, and calls me and tells me this.
Wow.
Because that's the kind of family we have.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't something that Jesse took lightly, and it's not something that she was afraid to tell us about. There was nobody else that she would have told. She actually, after I talked to her, she called her sister and had the same conversation, and then called her father and had the same conversation, and all of us were more or less, we were more concerned. Now, Jesse,
yeah.
Are you afraid of him? Did he threaten you? Are you worried? Are you scared to go back up to that room? She says, no, he's just an ass, Mom. I'm not afraid of him at all. I don't think he would ever do anything to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, because your option is staying in some lobby of a hotel in Manhattan.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
And getting home tomorrow. Like, Jesse had money. She didn't have to worry about not having a taxi. But she was invited down there on a trip. He didn't know that she had her own money in her own account from an accident.
Unless she told him, which, you know, we don't know if she ever told him or not.
No. We know that. Okay, here's what we do know.
Mm-hmm.
We know that if a trafficker knew that one of his victims had $20,000 in the bank, that money would not be in her bank.
Hmm. Okay.
So what we know, just because it's still there, is that this Jesse, I think, was smart enough, and it probably came from 2 years of living in the city in California. Because she was smart enough to do a few things, okay? Her cell phone bill and her credit card bills all came to my house. But nobody knew that. So when Jesse went missing, we had a record of every phone call ever made while she was gone.
Hmm.
We had so much information that there's no way these guys would have, quote-unquote, allowed us to have that information. So things like that, she didn't disclose. She didn't say, "Hi, my name's Jesse, you know, and I have all this money in the bank, and you know what, all my phone calls or, you know, bills are going to Mom's house, and so if anything happens to me, you know, like none of that, right?" So.
Mm-hmm. So they're in New York City, and she makes this call, and then the next day, what happens?
The next day, she calls me up, happy as she could be, excited. We're going to Las Vegas. I said, "What do you mean you're going to Las Vegas? Last night you had no money. He was trying to pimp you out." "No, everything was fine. But I got to go. Cab's coming. I'll call you when I get there." So she leaves me astounded. I actually said to her, "Don't you remember our phone call yesterday?" Because I sure do.
Yeah.
So she said, "You know, I'll call you when I get there." So several hours later, she did. She called me from Las Vegas, and she says, "Mom, it was May 14th. It was May 13th, 2005."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "It is 2 weeks exactly until my 21st birthday. And I'm just going to stay here until my birthday." And I said, "What?" She goes, "Yeah, you know, I have this friend, and her name's Yvonne, and he's got her boyfriend, Richard, and they're friends of Donald's." And I'm like, "What's that? What is going on here?" She assured me everything's fine. And I knew that she, you know, could afford 2 weeks gone. Not like she couldn't afford a two-week vacation or anything like that. So I said to her, though, I said, "Well," and this is kind of weird because some people go, "Oh, that's almost pathetic," but it was me, again, being dramatic, okay? I said to her, "Jesse, hey, listen, though, you're in Las Vegas, you're in another country. What if something happens to you? What if you went missing?" I said that to my daughter 10 months before she went missing. I said, "What if you ever went missing? How would I know where to start looking for you? Because I don't know anybody." She gave me Yvonne's phone number. A otherwise, I wouldn't have had any other number of anybody down there. But I ended up having that number, which turned out to be quite important because when I did end up calling that number 10 months later, I was pretty much dismissed.
And just, if I may, for the listeners here, she is talking about, Glenn Dean is talking about Yvonne Hubrickson, and you spell the name H-U-B-R-E-C-H-T-S-E-N.
Who, it's actually pronounced Yvonne Hubrickson.
Hubrickson.
And the only reason I know this is because I heard Jesse say it.
Okay.
Because it's a very different name.
Yes, it is.
But it made it easy for us when we looked her up to find out about her family.
Mm-hmm.
See, when Jesse first was telling me about her friend Yvonne, she told me how she had a brother who was in jail, and she wanted to know if Jesse had any friends who would like to be a pen pal to him and write him letters in jail just so that he would have something to look forward to. And she had told her, one of her friends up here in Kamloops, about this guy, and then they decided, no, you're not going to write to any guy. So that it never materialized, but I do remember Jesse telling me about that. And she had told me how she also had a younger brother who was killed.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the bar with a couple of friends, and they went outside to smoke a joint or smoke whatever, and his friend and the friend's girlfriend started fighting, and he kind of got in the middle of them to say, come on, you guys, we're here to have fun, and the boyfriend was going to stab the girlfriend, but stabbed him instead, and he died.
That was in California.
That was in California,
yes.
That's right. So when I looked all these things up, I did find an Yvonne who had a brother who was dead and a brother who was incarcerated, and the father who had been charged for, he had brandished a weapon to his wife, at his wife, that turned out to be like a not real, but it looked so real they charged them with a real weapon because it looked real enough to frighten the person.
Mm-hmm. But you found all of this out after Jesse disappeared.
After. What kind of family did she meet?
Yeah. So she gets to Las Vegas. Donald Voss is still there. She meets Yvonne, and she also meets Peter Todd. When did you first hear about Peter Todd?
Well, when Jesse's birthday came and went, I was saying to her, okay, when are you coming home? It's time to come home.
Jump in for a second. She's down there, but she had jobs that she had. How was she able to just leave and go to 2 weeks? Did she give them any explanation, or did she quit those jobs? What went on in that?
She did not quit them. Initially, Jesse's plan was never to be, and this is part of the reasons why we know she never planned on anything extended.
Mm-hmm.
She was putting off her bosses, you know, like saying, oh, I'm still down here, oh, I'm stuck down here, but, or whatever she said, okay.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, saying things. I don't know what.
You didn't hear the conversations, yes.
But then as time went on a little bit more, she said, if they call the house, Mom, don't tell them I'm still, you know. So she didn't want them to know that she was, like, on a holiday, quote, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
Because she had full intentions of coming back and going, she wanted to go back to her job at first, right? So now, after the 2 weeks, and then the birthday came, and then I'm like, oh, it's safe, time to come home, jobs are waiting, you got to get back. She told me how her and Yvonne had been driving down a street. There was a bus in front of them. The bus goes through a green light. They go through the same green light right behind the bus going in the same direction, and a car, a taxi, comes flying through the red light and hits Jesse's, the car Jesse's in.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's telling me that her and Yvonne have some kind of an intimacy that they have to go through because of this accident. So after a short time of waiting for some kind of accident thing to be settled, and I'm like, okay, Jesse, you got to get back here now. Then it's like, oh, I met a god. Yvonne's boyfriend, Richard Sprint, is this guy Peter, and I met him, and, you know, I really like him and all this stuff. So it started off, you know, just like that. And then it went from, we're seeing each other, and then it went to, oh, I'm moving in with him, and then it went to, we're engaged, and then...
How quickly was all that?
Well, she was living with him, I believe, before the end of June, and her birthday was May 27th.
Okay.
And she came back to Canada at the end of November until Christmas Day. She came back. She went to her younger sister's 19th birthday party that we had for her. She drove her car, which was always parked in my backyard because that's where she left it, and it was still insured and everything. Drove the car to Calgary, visited with her dad and stepmom, came back to Kamloops. The whole time that all of that she was there, whether it was in Kamloops or in Calgary, whether it was at our house or her dad's house,
mm-hmm.
She would be on the phone with Peter. But they wouldn't be, oh, I miss you. They would be fighting and screaming, and they would be yelling, and they would be swearing at each other. And So after a bit, I started thinking, okay, well, and now not only after listening to them fighting on the phone, and then time would go on, and then it was like a week and 2 weeks and 3 weeks, and I thought, she's not going back. I thought, you know, she had enough and she was going to distance herself. And, of course, being that he was in another country, it wasn't going to be all that hard to not see him again. And so I was starting to feel kind of like I was wishing that they would stop talking on the phone, but I was thinking that she was not going back. And then we got up on Christmas Day, and the plan was we're going to open our gifts and we're going to, you know, just do whatever. We always used to have like a junk food lunch on Christmas, like just chips and dip and oranges and chocolates and stuff. And we did that our whole lives. My kids did it when they were little, and now I do it with my grandkids. And then we were going to go to my dad's. My mom had passed. My dad was a widow, and so we were going up to his house. Since Jesse went missing, my dad has passed away. And because Jesse never did go there that day, they never ever saw each other again. Because Christmas morning, after we opened presents, Jesse told us that she needed a ride to the airport. She had a flight leaving Kamloops to Las Vegas at 2 o'clock that afternoon. And we had no pre-warning. All I kept saying to her is, who leaves on Christmas Day? She goes, a lot of people. And I go, who leaves on Christmas Day with nobody, without it being arranged? It's not like, oh, I think I'm going to fly out of town today. Like, it's Christmas Day. If you're somewhere for Christmas, you're not leaving that day unless everybody knows it and you pick a spot and the plan is that you have to leave that day.
Yeah.
There was no reason for it other than she insisted. So we ended up, before we went to my dad's, we all ended up piling into the vehicle and we drove her out to the airport. Kissed her and hugged her, and she walked into the security gate, and we never laid eyes on Jesse again.
So if I can ask, if I can ask you, so between May or June when she said she was moving in with this guy until she came home in December of 2005, what did she tell you she was doing in Las Vegas? Obviously, did she ever call her prior jobs and say, you know what, I'm not coming back? And she just kind of...
By the time she moved in with Peter, she had severed her job.
Okay.
She ended up telling him she was not coming back. And the reason they, she told him is, you know, I met a guy and he lives in Las Vegas and we're in love and I'm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept saying to her, okay, he's in the United States, just in Canada. You can't just go there and meet a guy and live there. Like I said, it's a process and you have to apply, go there, you have to be accepted. And he's not even an American citizen himself, so it's not like you could marry him and become one. Like, so, but in my eyes, I thought she just didn't give a crap about that stuff. That was just details. But, you know, obviously afterwards we realized that there was a lot more to it.
But what was she, what did you see, she tell you she was doing? I think you told me that she told you, well, he has a lot of money and I'm just staying with him and she wasn't working.
Okay.
No, she wasn't working at all. I always knew that Jesse had money. So if like, say they had a fight and he kicked her out, she wasn't going to be stranded anywhere. And if she needed to rent, you know, pay rent, I knew that she had money to do so. But that never happened. That was never necessary. She said he was wealthy, him and his identical twin brother. And I found out since he had sisters, too. But at the time, it was, you know, just him and his brother. But they were from a wealthy family, trust fund children, and they got monthly money from their parents. And we never had anything to worry about. So, you know, mm-hmm. It's not like she, you know, said she was working illegally or anything like that. It was never anything but a job.
Well, as you know, I lived in Las Vegas for 13 years. And in fact, you know, in the introduction to this interview, I told the listeners that this was all going on when I lived there. So, and I can tell you from my experience that her telling you that she was, you know, a young, beautiful woman living with an older guy and him paying for all the thing is not unusual in Las Vegas. It might be unusual in some other city, but not in Las Vegas. That's actually very common. So, you know, I just want to let the listeners know that.
Anywhere.
Okay.
Anywhere, everywhere that there's a young woman and an older man that are attracted to each other, it happens. It might not be flaunted a lot, and perhaps unless you live in that circle, you might not even see it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like wealthy men in my city with young, vibrant wives come out and shop at the bakery where, you know, down the street from me. So we wouldn't cross paths, per se, right? So, but you're right, in Las Vegas, you see all kinds, everything goes. And I actually changed the motto of Las Vegas. I don't think I told you this, but I'll tell you now.
Please.
Okay, the motto of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. After hearing about other missing women, after hearing about women being dismembered, other women being found encased in cement in basements, I changed the motto to what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, encased in cement in a basement or buried in the Mojave.
Oh,
that's my take on Las Vegas, and I apologize.
That's all right. That's fine. You don't have to apologize.
That's just me. Yeah. But yeah, so
you have every right, Glenn Dean. If anybody has any right to make fun of Las Vegas, you do.
And that's not even making fun because from the heart, I do. Yeah. There's been too many bodies found in the Mojave and too many bodies found encased in cement in statements. Yeah. But then I guess I have to say that happens in other parts of the country and the world and the continent. Also, so, you know, but we're just talking about Las Vegas at the moment. I do want to tell you another thing, too. Now, after Jesse went missing, that's March 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So from Christmas Day, when we last saw her, until the 28th of March, we talked to her daily. I might not have talked to her every day, nor maybe her sister talked every day. But between her sister, myself, her stepmom, her dad, her friends, her other sisters, somebody did talk to Jesse daily.
Mm-hmm.
I started realizing many things after Jesse went missing. And one thing that really stood out to me was when Jesse's sister talked to her on the 28th of March and then failed to get a hold of her on the 29th and the 30th, she told me, she says, Mom, I called Jesse all day yesterday and today, and she's not answering.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the 30th, on the 30th, 31st of March, her other sister, Katie, says, Mom, I called Jesse all day yesterday, which was the 30th, and today, and she's not getting a hold of me. Well, 29th, 30th, and 31st, I'm like, there's something wrong. I started calling. I started emailing and calling and calling and calling and calling. And all I could think of later on was part of her constant contact, I believe, was she knew what was going on to her. She knew by the time Jesse went missing, she knew that things had gone bad, I think. She knew that something possibly could happen, I think.
Yeah.
And so the contact stopping, suddenly, boom, one day stopping, and that's it. Not dwindling off, but stopping, got her attention immediately. We tried to report her missing on the 31st of March, and they wouldn't let us in North Las Vegas because her dad and stepfamily was in Mexico for one of her stepsister's weddings. And they're...
Was she invited to go to that wedding?
She was invited, but she wasn't going.
Yeah, she was, but she was not, yeah.
They decided that she must have went at the last minute. So they have made us wait until the 9th of August for them, the 9th of April for them to come back to find out if Jesse had been with them the whole time. In the meantime, there's no phone calls from Jesse saying, hey, I went to Mexico last minute, nothing like that. No emails saying, don't worry about me, I got the voicemail, I'm in Mexico, So we knew. All they did was postpone the inevitable by making us wait almost 2 weeks to report her missing. And another thing, too, after Jesse went missing, we went through the storage unit that I told you she had in Calgary where she put all of her belongings. And we discovered some items in that storage unit that further proved to me that what I had said, she knew what was going on. She knew things were probably turning bad or could turn bad, perhaps. And so we found pictures of Donald Bowden, and Peter Todd, and Yvonne Huck Breton, and Richard Wolcott, and everybody who we knew after, Jesse went missing, we knew that those were the ones that had something to do with her disappearance.
Yeah.
And we didn't find them for a couple of months after, even though we suspected greatly that they were involved, because we figured that she put them in that locker when she went to Calgary that December to visit her dad and step family, and because if Jesse never went missing, nobody would have ever seen those pictures.
Right.
And no, it would not have mattered if they were there.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point. Yes, yes.
Right? And so now we have phone calls that suddenly stop and pictures stashed away in a locker of people suspected to have something to do. Now, if that doesn't tell you that Jesse was concerned about what was going on, then I'll tell you what happened back again. We'll go back to June. Jesse got there.
June 2005.
June 2005, she moves in with Peter Todd, this new boyfriend. After Jesse went missing, we found out that in June of 2005 that Jesse had been hospitalized with a broken jaw and that she had been arrested for solicitation of prostitution.
So it was very quick. From the time that she got to Las Vegas till she got the broken jaw by Peter Todd and being charged with prostitution was very fast.
2 weeks. 2 weeks for the broken jaw, 3 weeks for the charges. And then she kept in constant contact with us, came back to Canada, put pictures in a locker, went back suddenly on Christmas Day, and went missing 3 months later. Now, Jesse was planning, right at the time of her disappearance, to come back to Canada again. This is what we believe was the scenario. Because Crystal is Jesse's older sister, And Crystal was planning to go to Las Vegas for a weekend. Then Crystal and Jesse were going to fly back to Canada together because they were going to go to the stepsister's wedding reception in Calgary when they got back from Mexico in April. Okay, so mm-hmm. are you following? So in at the end of March, they were planning for Crystal to go down there at the beginning of April, for them to come back together, Kamloops, to get Jesse's car from my backyard in Kamloops,
yeah,
and drive to Calgary together to go to this wedding reception. To which the cops suddenly just assumed that she ditched her sister's plans to go to Vegas, ditched her plans to drive to Calgary with her for the reception, and go off to Mexico for the wedding without telling anyone, therefore giving Peter Todd from the, you know, the 29th of March to the 9th of April to clean up his house or do whatever he needed to do.
Yes.
So when Jesse went missing and the police showed up there, all they could brag about was they let them in without a warrant and everything was fine. Well, no doubt. He had 10 days, 12 days to clean the house up. And not like I think he killed her and had blood splatter everywhere. I believe he took her and he either moved her somewhere else to continue trafficking her in prostitution or sold her to somebody else and continued to do that. So it's not like they had some bloody crossing. Here's what was I was also told. I was also told by Peter Todd that the last time he saw Jesse was April 3rd, that she had left the house to go for a dentist appointment, and when he came, then he went out. When he came home later, not only did she not come back, but then all her belongings were gone too. Oh, except her
Right. Her makeup. Yeah.
Yeah. So as soon as he said she left her hair dryer and makeup, I told him to call the cops and report her missing because she would not leave those. I think what had happened was her things were packed. Her sister was coming. She was leaving. He probably assumed, and probably correctly, that she was not going back this time. She had gotten strong. After 10 months of being beaten in traffic in Las Vegas, she wasn't some scared little girl anymore. She knew what she was doing. She had been put through a lot. And they weren't going to let her cross that border and come back into Canada. Not after what they invested in her. And it's also because of that I don't believe... I mean, if you could make $1,500 to $3,000 off of one person daily, why would you take that and kill it? And I don't mean it as in the girl. I mean it as in that income.
Yeah.
No, you're not going to give up that much money. That turns, over the years, that turns into millions of dollars. And the way it was in the day is people got rich selling drugs, but the drugs needed to be replenished. Now they sell people, but they don't always have to replenish the people because they're reusing the people. Unlike drugs, a person can be resold over and over and over and used over and over and over.
So all these people talking to her, including you, from Christmas 2005 to the end of March 2006, there was never any indication from Jesse that there was a kind of escalation going on. That
nothing.
She never said that I'm really afraid of him, that I'm going to, I mean, she was pretty tight-lipped.
Yes, very tight-lipped. I think she basically knew better She learned her lesson. She knew how to behave. And telling her mom or dad who would hop on a plane and, you know, fly down to Vegas and drag her kicking and screaming out of that house or whatever, that just couldn't be an option, right? Yeah.
There
is somebody that she said that to. There is somebody that she told she was afraid of. Somebody who saw bruises on her, And this is the person who ran an escort agency that Peter Todd had her working over.
Right.
This woman told me that she kind of took Jesse under her wing, that there was just something about Jesse that was different than other girls, that she didn't feel that Jesse came to Las Vegas to be a prostitute, that she didn't become a prostitute to feed a drug habit that she had picked up along the way. She said she was a nice girl, and she did not belong there. As a matter of fact, she would say to me, she would tell me that she would say to Jesse, little girl, go home, you don't belong here. And Jesse, on more than one occasion, said to her, I can't leave, I'm too afraid. And she would see bruises on Jesse, on her arms and things. So she knew that she may not have known Jesse was literally being beaten, but she knew that she was being manhandled and that Jesse was afraid. So when it did come to us hearing her say, you know, I'm afraid, that never happened. But we do have one person who did hear her say that.
Tell the listeners about the phone call that you had with Yvonne once you ended up reaching her after Jesse disappeared. What happened there?
Well, it's that's what I had said earlier, how when I told Jesse that, what if you go missing and you're in Las Vegas and I never know how to get a hold of you, what will I do? And she gave me Yvonne's phone number. So when Jesse went missing, I started calling it, and all I was got for the first several tries was voicemail. And then a friend of mine told me that I should call off my phone number so that she could see it wasn't British Columbia number.
Yeah.
And try calling. And to me, I was like, oh my God, why would you even think that? Her friend would, you know, and that, you know, was my attitude was, that's not necessary. But I did it anyways. And, well, lo and behold, she answered the phone immediately, practically. And so I kind of just played her along. I go, Yvonne's nickname is Angel.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, hey, Angel, how's it going? And I tried to sound all young, even though I'm an old lady, but I lightened my voice and sounded cheery. And she replied by, I'm good. Who's this?
Yeah.
And I said, well, hey, aren't you coming over later? Oh, no, actually, I kind of said it in the wrong order. She goes, I'm fine, like kind of one, trying to see if she could recognize my voice. So I'm like, well, I thought you were coming over later. She goes, who is this? And I just hung up.
Huh.
And I looked at my friends, and I went, oh, my God. She must have some knowledge of what happened to Jesse, or why would she not answer my call?
Right.
And then after several tries of trying to reach Peter Todd, I call blocked his my number too and finally reached him. And these are people who were supposed to be her friends. So when my friend Faye were to go missing, I'm not going to play dumb like I don't know who you are or who she is, or not answer your phone calls and return your frantic messages. You know, I'm gonna call and see what the heck's going on, you know. So we knew, you know.
No.
I kept tabs on Peter Todd. As a matter of fact, about 3 years after Jesse went missing, I got a new number of his, because I actually have people who will call me up and say, hey, I have a new number for Peter if you want it. And so I, you know, of course I'll take it. And so I called him up, you know, it was about 3 years after Jesse went missing, and I said, hey, Peter, how's it going? And he goes, who's this? And I just said, it's Glendine. And he said, Glendine who?
Oh, my.
And I said, how many Glendines do you know, Peter Todd? This is Jesse Foster's mother. And he went, oh. But I, you know, obviously he knew.
Yeah, I bet he did. Of course he did.
He didn't need my last name. I mean, Grant would tell you no more than what you would get if he, you know, I'm like a one-name person, right? He really only needs to hear Glendine, and he must know who I am, because I'm the only one you know.
Yeah. You're the only Glenn Dean I know.
Right?
Yeah.
And I know I'm the only Glenn Dean he knows, so.
Here's something that I found interesting is that, and we had had a couple emails back and forth about this, is that right around the time that you were trying to get a hold of Yvonne, and actually did get eventually hold of her, it looks from, because we can go online in a criminal record, we can find that not long after Jesse went missing, she was caught for prostitution in Salt Lake City. Not long after that. So
not only did she get arrested in Utah at that time,
yeah,
as if perhaps, you know, she had not meant to get arrested, but distanced herself from Las Vegas. Peter Todd's estranged wife, who he was never divorced from, and who was
Trish
Van Arsdale,
mm-hmm.
Was in Puerto Rico, and we found this because we found a guest book that she had signed after she left the resort. And she was there at the same time that Jesse went missing. So, again, it's quite ironic how, many of these main players were not even in Las Vegas at the time of Jesse's disappearance.
Right.
But the main player was.
Right.
Peter Todd was. Yeah.
And it should be noted for the record that if any listeners want to go online and look for Yvonne's name, you're going to find an extensive criminal record. Extensive. From not just Nevada, but in California, Utah.
Right, and the same with Trish Van Arsdale.
Yes,
and
yes.
And the prostitution-related charges.
Yes.
And I'll tell you something. There's a woman, there's been more than one, there's been several women who had the unfortunate luck to cross paths with Peter Todd in their life. One of them he became very close to, and I ended up talking to her father and her sister and a couple of her sisters, and all of them told me how he was this horrible person and how he had beat her and forced her into prostitution and basically kept her with him under force. Like, you could say same story, different name.
Mm-hmm.
And then another young woman who was only a teenager when she ran away from home and went to Las Vegas, and she was just sitting on a park bench on a somewhere when Peter Todd drove by, and she had nowhere to go, and he offered her a place, and it was 7 years later that she he actually let her go. And she went back home to her mom. But he kept her basically as a sex, as a slave, the prostitute, from 16 until about 24 years old. And she contacted me after seeing an article about Jesse in a Las Vegas newspaper where Jesse's picture was literally the entire front page of this newspaper.
I remember.
With the caption,
I remember.
Yep.
I remember. I lived there. I remember.
Yeah. And that, when she saw that, something caught her. She didn't know. She knew nothing about the details, but something about the look in Jesse's face. She got that newspaper, and she read it, and she couldn't go back to sleep that night. She talked to her mom, and the next day her mom called me, told me the story, and asked me if I wanted to, her daughter would be going to talk to me. And so I know a lot about not just him.
Yeah.
But she would tell me about how if these girls didn't listen, Trish would corner them in the bathroom and beat them, and Peter would stand guard at the door. So if they tried to get by her, he would beat them. And this came from a woman that this happened to.
This was a woman before Jesse or after Jesse?
Before,
okay.
Yeah.
Did Peter Todd have any women after Jesse, to your knowledge?
Well, I've had a few that I talked to that were friends with him, and one that he tried very hard to prostitute out. From what I have heard is he doesn't have a lot of luck with women anymore. I don't know if it's because all someone has to do is Google his name and they could run the other way.
Yeah.
Or not, But I do know that he has had to resort to selling less women, and now he sells cocaine.
Hmm. Now, we, I mean, all of this, you know, is horrible, but... there's if the listeners can't think it get any more horrible than you've already heard, Peter Todd has a twin brother, right, who lived in the house where Jesse lived. Identical twin. Tell us a little bit about him and what his job is.
Well, James and Peter, identical twins. The only difference at the time that Jesse lived there was that James had short hair. Peter had dreadlocks. They're black men. They're Jamaican descent. They were born in London, England, but they have Jamaican descent. And James worked for the Las Vegas, or the Clark County School District.
Wow.
He is what I understand a sports therapist counselor, which means that he has close physical contact to many of these the children that are in the junior high school, and it scares me.
Meanwhile, his twin brother. Meanwhile, his twin brother was a pimp, a sex trafficker, a drug dealer. You know, with a criminal record, and he's working for the Clark County School District.
And living in the same home. Now, here's why. Now, there's nothing to say that he has anything to do with it. I want everybody to leave
of course.
Opinion. This show is about what I think happened to Jesse.
Sure.
And the things that I believe was going on.
Sure.
Which includes why I'm concerned about the job James has.
Yes.
He can sue me if he wants, but I'm just saying it concerns me.
Mm-hmm.
I go into high schools and I get talked about human trafficking, and I see troubled children, and I know how troubled children can be led astray. So I get concerned. But there's things that James has done that causes, it's his own fault that I feel this way. For one, when Jesse first went missing, I spoke with James on the phone. James himself told me about how there were times where Peter would go out and leave his young 5-year-old son at home, and James would basically be watching him, but not like a babysitter. It's because he lived there and he was not going anywhere. And Jesse would be there. So many times it would just be the three of them, and they just hung out and talked, watched movies. He told me how a lot of times Jesse wore high heels and their legs would hurt, and he... Because he's a sports therapist counselor, he massaged her calves and things. And he told me these things. And he actually was interviewed for an article in a Calgary newspaper where Jesse, where her dad and family live. And the article talks about how the roommate is shocked at the sudden disappearance and how he keeps his distance from what his brother does. He knows nothing about it. Well, on the 10-year of Jesse's disappearance in March of this year, he was contacted by a Las Vegas newspaper, to which his answers now are, he never lived in the house with them, knows nothing about Jesse and Peter's, what they did, or anything about her disappearance. And the moment I got a copy of that article and I read it, and I saw his quote in this current news article after 10 years, I went into my archive of news articles from Jesse, and I sent her back not just a printout, but a picture of the physical newspaper with the article, Roommate Shocked. And there's James Tuck being interviewed, because guess what? He was the roommate.
Yeah.
So... be careful about the lies you tell, because sometimes you forget what they are, and 10 years later, you're going to tell a different story.
Right. Do you, now that, obviously, it's been 10 years, and you look back, it's over 10 years, and you look back at all of this, and... here's something I think the listeners would like to do. Why do you think that, for example, when Jesse went home for Christmas in 2005. Why don't you think she stayed there? Obviously, she had already started. You didn't know it was going on, but of course she knew it. She was experiencing it. What do you tell the listeners who say, well, she should have just left. She should have just stayed in Canada.
Well, don't you tell every victim they should have just left? Whether it's somebody who's being abused by a husband or whatever, mm-hmm. don't you say, well, why didn't they leave? Mm-hmm. How come they kept going back? Well, they have been beaten down and threatened, and they are deadly afraid. And just picture 5 weeks of phone call, of screaming and yelling, and who knows what being said on the other end. Mm-hmm. But whatever was said was enough for Jesse to get up Christmas Day and leave her family and fly out to another country, knowing when she got there she's going to be beaten and raped by these Johns. So all I can imagine is, you stay, we come and get your sister.
Right.
You stay, we come and kill your mother. You stay, we we'll just replace you. There's got to be something very drastic, and every listener can just imagine what would be the worst possible scenario that somebody could say to you that would make you leave the safety of your family, and the only thing would be to protect that family.
Yeah, right. And you, just to be clear with all the listeners, you didn't find about anything that Jesse was doing until she disappeared. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that she had been, Peter Todd had been beating her and she had been a prostitute with all these charges? How long after her disappearance did you find that out?
Well, her dad came back from Mexico April 9th to messages on his voicemail saying, is Jesse with you? Please won't let us report her missing until we know if she went to Mexico. To him calling up and finding out that she's missing. To him getting on the phone and just through Google search finding a private investigator, hiring him over the phone that night. And the next morning, we get a phone call from the private investigator saying, are you sitting down? Jesse was beaten and hospitalized and arrested for solicitation all in June and then arrested again in September of 2005. There was a bail bondsman who was holding her case and she was expected back in court. And that was April 10th.
I can't imagine that.
I don't actually want anyone to.
Yeah, I know, I know. I know you don't. As if her being gone isn't bad enough. So you went down to Las Vegas. Tell us about your experience with Vegas Metro, and listeners should know that Glendine and I have had a prior conversation before this interview, so that's why I know some of these things. Tell about your interaction with Vegas Metro.
Well, first of all, I have to let everybody know, Jesse's case isn't being dealt with by Metro, by Las Vegas Police at all.
Okay.
North Las Vegas.
Right.
And I just want to say something before I talk about how the police have worked with us. Other women that have gone missing from Las Vegas that we know were forced into prostitution, and we know this because of other beatings and arrests.
Yeah.
They were never actually housed in Las Vegas. They were either, like with Lindsay Harris, living in Henderson or Jesse in North Las Vegas. The reason being is these are smaller cities that have smaller police departments. They don't have a million people living in the city, so they don't have a metro police department. They don't have a pandering squad. They don't have the vice team. As a matter of fact, Jesse's officer, the detective on Jesse's missing persons case, was a robbery officer.
Hmm.
Like they didn't have a missing persons department.
Yeah.
So I believe part of their grand scheme is when, and if you do notice, I didn't say if, but when these guys know that some of their girls will go missing, they're not going to be handled by a big very good police department. They're going to be handled by, oh, let me just see. I'll call North Las Vegas Police Department clown, if I may, my opinion. When I first started trying to work with them, they wouldn't let me report a missing because I told you, you know, she's probably in Mexico.
Yeah.
I didn't bother to tell you because, you know, that would be how inconsiderate she is. Then, when they finally did, they went to the house, you know, almost 2 weeks later. He let the cops in, and they looked around the house, and they left, and so all they could do was say, oh, he was so cooperative, and he didn't even ask for a warrant. He just let them in, you know. Well, if you know they're not going to find anything, why would you want to look like you're hiding something, right? So then when we found out about Jesse being arrested and all this, and then, you know, the beating, and then us putting those together with the fact that that is exactly how you would describe a human trafficking victim, somebody who is beaten and forced into the sex trade is a human trafficking victim, you know, mm-hmm. in its worst state. And when I told the detective that Jesse had been prostituted out and arrested, he felt inclined to inform me that I had everything all wrong. Prostitution did not happen in North Las Vegas, but prostitution happened down on the Strip. And I looked at him and I said, what? Prostitution happens everywhere.
Yeah.
And he said, no, not here. So now they are even in denial that anything happened to Jesse, and everything that happened to her, they believe she brought on herself.
Yeah.
Basically, their reasoning to not put their best effort in is if a Canadian wants to come to our beautiful city and prostitute herself out, then she's going to get what's coming to her. They didn't take her broken jaw and the arrest all within weeks of being there as anything. They blamed her for everything. And for years, we had the same detective, so nothing really changed. It took me finally until October of 2006 to actually go to Las Vegas, because I kept assuming they're going to find her and bring her home, and what can I do down
yeah.
there, right?
Yeah.
What can one mother do in a city like that? Nothing. But over the months, and I became very quickly an activist, an advocate, an abolitionist, and everything that I could do in Jesse's name and as her voice, I would. So by then, I'm like, I'm ready to go down there. I'm ready to talk to media. I'm ready to, you know, get in the cops and face that they're not going to just welcome me. So I went down there with my best friend, and we were there for 10 days. And I tried to pre-arrange a meeting with the police to no avail. Then again, I kept phoning every day to see if he could squeeze me in that day, squeeze me in that day. I flew from Kamloops, British Columbia, Canada, to Las Vegas to look for my missing child, and the detective on the case couldn't even squeeze me in. Finally, the very last day before we were going to leave, I'm on the phone, and I'm like, hey, we're leaving tomorrow. If I don't see you today or tomorrow, I won't have a chance to talk to you on here.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, you know what I can do? I can meet you at your car rental agency, and I can drive you to the airport instead of taking the shuttle, and we can talk. And I know it's not long, but at least we can talk for a bit. And I, thank you. And I hang up, and I say, oh, at least we're going to do this. And my friend Brenda looks at me literally like as if she's looking at the dumbest person, you know, in the world, and she said, he doesn't want to talk to us. He wants to make sure that we get on the plane.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes, oh, absolutely.
So we had a full 10, 15 minutes of talking with him after 10 days in his fair city, and that was it. The next time I planned on going down there was January 2007, and this time Jesse's dad, Dwight, decided to come with me. However, he wasn't as inclined to be down there very long. He actually said he wanted to go all the way down there for 2 days. And I'm thinking that's a waste. No, we don't live in the same city. We weren't going to be flying down together. We were going to be meeting down there. So I actually kind of pulled a quick one, and I booked my flight a week before him. Then I booked him because I had started a fund and an account for Jersey and did all the fundraising to pay for these trips and stuff. And so I booked mine and his flight. So all he had to do was print his tickets and go. And he saw nothing of my itinerary, nothing. So I go down. My husband drives me to the airport. I go down a week early by myself to Las Vegas. I, at the time, was like 48-year-old woman. I'm 58 now, 10 years later. Going down by myself because I'm going to go look for my daughter, right? I'm taking media with me. I've got plans to talk to the Las Vegas media already set up. I actually have Canadian media flying down from Calgary the same day that Dwight was going to be there. There was Global Television cameraman and anchorman, and they were going to follow us around, and they were going to watch us hand out posters and talk to our media and talk to the police and everything. But I went a week early because I wanted to arrange all of these things. I wanted to have more things set up, and I wanted to have posters everywhere, and I just didn't think going there for 2 days was going to really do much.
Yeah.
And the day that I left, Dwight actually phoned my house right after Jim got home from the airport because he wanted to confirm something with me for the trip next week. And, so anyways, I got into trouble because they discovered that I had left for Las Vegas that day, and it was too late for them to do anything about it because I was already gone. And you know what? That's just what a mom will do, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't worried about me. They were more worried about me than I was.
Right.
All I could say was, well, I said to my friend Brenda, I said, here's all my stuff, all my backup drive, all my every bit of information I have. Because if they kill me while I'm down there, you make sure that the media knows Jesse Foster is missing in Las Vegas. Her mother goes down to find her and she's killed. You make sure.
Yeah.
And here's everything. I wouldn't. I wasn't planning on being a martyr, but I'm like, if anything, I am more scared over what is happening to Jesse than I am over what can happen to me. And everything turned out fine. Everything went well. I came home safe and sound, but without Jesse. But the bottom line is, you don't mess with the mom.
No,
right?
Of course
that's
not.
That's
I know.
The bottom line.
I know.
You don't want to be there with me, then you can come a little later, but I'm not waiting.
Right.
And that's just the way it is, right? And it's always been that way. And when the police try to go around me and maybe talk to her dad or not want to talk to me because I'm obnoxious and I'm loud and I yell and I might even swear because I'm, because of their, just the way they're treating me, I don't care. I am Jesse's voice. I am her spokesperson. I gave birth to her. Her father can't even talk about her anyways.
Yeah.
So don't get, if you can't get over that in a decade, then you're never going to get over it. About a year or so ago, a new detective was put on the case. This new detective, every single time we talk, and I'm a loud person, you probably have even noticed that, during this conversation.
Yes.
I have never once yelled or screamed. I get loud. I get excited. And my voice goes up. I have to say I'm a middle child, and that's just part of our trait. But she hangs up on me every time. Sometimes I think she might be bored, so she calls me up. And instead of saying, okay, let's just start over, she'll say, well, that last conversation we had, where you just wouldn't, and then she, it's like she's instigating me or egging me on again. And I'm like, why are you, bringing that up? And why can't you just stop treating me like this? And then click, she hangs up on me. And then, I'm like, oh, I guess I needed to give her some entertainment today because, seriously, there's absolutely no reason for those phone calls if all she knows she's going to do in the end is hang up. And if you cannot handle a mother whose daughter is missing, who's getting excited while you're on the phone with her, then how did you ever, ever make it to the status of detective?
Yeah, this was a conversation that I had with Kelly Murphy, the mother of Jason Jolkowski, the prior episode to this, about how policemen are not trained in disappearances. They're not trained to report them. They don't know how to handle parents. And that's something that we in the United States have to get a lot better at.
Exactly. And to take it one step further, because I do a lot with educating people on the specific crime of human trafficking, they also need to be educated on how to deal with human trafficking victims, because they were likely at one point missing and now found, and they think because they don't want to talk to you that they just don't care. But the thing is, the trauma they've been through. So you need not only to have the police, but all frontline workers educated on how to handle, you know, the loved ones of the missing, the loved ones of the human trafficking victims, and the human trafficking victims themselves who are rescued. Because without knowing how to deal with us, you just are left with a big, huge group of angry people. I mean, you can't begin to understand how. Okay, let's just start it like this. I'm trying to have a conversation about to report a tip on Jesse, and they're putting me through the voicemails and telling me to punch in numbers to extensions that weren't given to me. I'd have to hang up and call back. So by the time I speak to somebody, my frustration level is gone from, you know, 3 to 6. So now I'm finally talking to somebody. And I'm like, thank God I'm talking to you. I'm trying to explain to them what I was just put through. And whether it's important in the conversation because I've got other things to tell them or not, it's something that has me kind of my level raised at that moment. And I'm not asking for you to, you know, give me anything except let me vent for this moment, and then we'll get on. But instead of, you know, maybe letting me vent by saying, I can't believe it, this person did this, and then they told me this, and then they said this, and oh, thank God I'm talking to you, I get replies like, yeah, I heard that phone call. We all listened to that phone call. And all I can think of is, what? Like, what were you? Was I on?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I bothering you? I'm sorry.
Exactly, right? Or did I give you some sort of entertainment of today? Because they must have replayed it, the recording later, for we all to hear it, you know?
Yeah.
So then I'm like, what? So now you just pissed me off more. So now I'm trying to report a tip, but I want to tell you how frustrating it was to get through to you. And now you just told me that you were all listening to this click. Because now my frustration went from 6 to 9, right?
What have you learned in the last 10 years about sex trafficking that, once again, looking back at it 2020, being that you didn't know what Jesse was into, could you have gotten it out of her? Were there warning signs that you should have seen now that you have the training and you have the experience looking back at that?
Practically everything. Do you want to know how many people are told about having to hang around for an insurance claim or the boyfriend, which is actually referred to as love bombing? There's different stories. Now, if you have a young woman who was raised in poverty, perhaps maybe every outfit she ever got was a hand-me-down from her sister or her older cousin, what they're going to do is they're going to wine her and dine her, and they're going to buy her fancy things and nice clothes.
Mm-hmm.
If she's a drug addict and doesn't really care about clothing, she just wants her next fix, then they're going to, you know, buy them with drugs.
Of course.
If none of those really, you know, fancy them, because like in Jesse's case, she bought her own clothes and she didn't use drugs, but she was a 20-year-old young woman who loved the idea of love, then they will make you fall in love with them. So we know these. So as soon as somebody said, oh, she's got a new boyfriend and everything changed, and suddenly she's wearing $800 shoes and getting $300 hair extensions, you got to tell me that there's a sign right there, and it's early on. The fact that if she's in high school and spent every Friday night, grades 8 through 11, watching movies with her girlfriend, suddenly in grade 12 she's got a new boyfriend and she doesn't spend any time with you at all.
Mm-hmm.
Those are signs. They might not be severe signs because the girls are still coming home at night and going to school in the day.
Is there anything a parent can do? Say there is a parent out there listening to this right now, and they suspect that their 20-year-old daughter, doesn't even have to be in Vegas, can be anywhere, is involved in some sort of thing where she's being forced into sex. They may not know it like you didn't, but there is a suspicion. What are they supposed to do? What's a parent supposed to do?
Well, first of all, nowadays, that is one of the first suspicions, because it is so out there now, and there are so many, like Dateline and different shows that talk about cases about it. So now it's something that pops into your mind almost right away. So if you think, okay, something's wrong, like say for instance, like in Jessie's case where she just completely vanished, and you realize things had happened, you know, things like she was pulling away from you and different behaviors, maybe, dressing differently and things like that, then right away you kind of, start tracking where, her phone, her email, things like that. You need to find out where she is, if she's still in the city. And police nowadays, especially in larger cities, they have human trafficking task forces, and they are more willing to help. They don't make you wait 48 hours or 2 weeks. They get on it right away. One of the biggest things that I see a change in how some police departments handle just a simple missing case, and I don't want to use the word simple, but I just want to preface it with that, because back in the day, those simple missing case reports, you had to wait 48 hours, or if they're a grown-up, they can do what they want. If they want to go missing, they can. Has now gone to where anybody can report someone missing, not just a mother or a loved one, and you don't have to wait 48 hours. And the person's lifestyle and behavior has a lot to do with how they handle it. Like, if I was to, report Jessie missing today and how close she was with her family and how, thin she was, they would be on it quicker than if I reported her missing and she had been a chronic runaway through high school, arrested for drugs or stealing when she was 20, and prostitution when she was 21. They may not take those cases as urgent, but they still take them serious. They might give them a little more leeway, like, well, let's give her a day, see if anyone hears from her in a day, rather than taking it right away, or let's give her a couple of days and see, because we see that she's been reported missing before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, so a lot of those things have changed. And here's something that you really, really need to do. And don't worry if you're going to piss your daughter or son off. Make the report. Even if they're only gone for a short time, if there's a knot in your stomach or your intuition or whatever you want to call it is telling you something's wrong, pick up the phone, call the police. Report them missing. They can come back tomorrow, big deal. It's on record.
Mm-hmm.
And then that way they have the daughter or the son, they are now aware that the police know who they are and that they've been reported once as missing. If they continue to do it, some places even have laws for this, you can be charged. You can even have to pay back fees for your search if you chose to just go missing on your own. But it will also enable the police to know that, well, look at, there's three times. You reported her missing. She came back in 2 days. But now it's 5 days. Now it's a week. This is not normal behavior. Even if going missing for a couple of days is normal behavior for somebody who might be on drugs or into prostitution, because maybe they might go out of town for some of their jobs. You don't know. But 4 days, 5 days with no communication, no Facebook posting, no emails, no touching base with anybody, even if it's their drug dealer, then they look at it differently. So, you know, things have come a long way.
Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear.
Yeah, I mean, people are still going missing. People are still being forced into prostitution. But we have a lot more people being found, a lot more people being rescued, a lot more people making other choices simply because somebody is trying to get them, but maybe they call the Jesse. And they're like, you know what? I don't know if I want to go on this trip. I don't know if I want to trust this guy and go, you know, because they've heard a lot of stories of other young women. And they're making a difference. And, you know, Jesse has been missing for 10 years, and we've gone through a lot in those 10 years. But one thing that we have learned after all that time is how to cope with living with a missing loved one. It's not easy, but you learn. Well, either you learn or you seriously have had a miserable 10 years. And I have other children. I now have grandchildren. And I have this wonderful thought in my head of Jesse coming home one day. And I'll tell you, I do not want to be part of the first hurdle that she has to get over. Because she comes home to a family of messed up people who had no way of getting through 10 years because they never learned how to cope with her disappearance.
Right.
So she has to deal with that before she can deal with the fact that she was trafficked for 10 years. So... no, we're going to eliminate that, and she's going to come back. She's going to see a law in Canada called Jesse's Law that was dubbed after her name that we had changed. She's going to know there's a star up in the sky named after her. She's going to see documentaries and books that were all done about her story that helped educate other people. And she's going to, you know, see that her mom got off of her butt and got out there, and oh, my gosh, look at this.
Yeah.
She has helped in your name, Jesse. You have been missing for 10 years, and you have saved thousands of people.
Right.
Now, I can't ask but for one other thing, and that is for this to have never happened. But I'll tell you something, else. If I wished for that, and I came to this conclusion several years ago, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When I actually stopped wishing, I used to, oh, I wish this didn't happen. I wish, you know, because that's kind of how people are. I stopped wishing that this didn't happen to Jesse. I stopped wishing that this didn't happen to us. And there's two reasons. And one is because, you know, it was a wish and it wasn't really doing any good. Okay. So before anyone thinks I'm a terrible mother, let's understand that I wrap my brain around the fact that wishing wasn't getting us anywhere anyway. And if she hadn't have gone missing, we would have had one nice little happy family who never knew the pain. But there would have been those other thousands of people who were helped by Jesse's disappearance, who were helped by her story, and they wouldn't have had that help. So they would either be missing, or they could be dead, or they could be in turmoil.
That's a good point, way to look at it.
I had to realize that Jesse and I were no more valuable than the next mom and the next daughter, or the thousand moms and the thousand daughters. We were far from more valuable than the thousands. So I just and you can't understand the peace that came to me when I did that, because it took the pain and the torture of the wishing this didn't happen and oh, what could I have done? Well, nothing. We didn't know, we weren't there. Nothing could have been done differently from the way it happened unless Jesse just pulled us all up on the plane and left, and then again it wouldn't have happened, right?
Yeah.
So, when you take yourself out of an equation and you make it about others, it makes it a very valuable thing, and it makes it so much more worthwhile. And I haven't got regrets. I sure sometimes I'll be wishing. Like I go to work at 2:00 a.m. So many times I'm heading to work and I'm sorry. And I'm a kid at heart, and I'm like, so light for star I see tonight. I wish it may, I wish it might get the star, get the wish I wish tonight. And my wish every night is, I wish Jesse will come home. But that's the extent of me wishing. But who doesn't wish on a star, right?
Yep.
Where can people reach you, find out what you're doing, what you're continuing to doing, continue to do? I know you're on Facebook, website. Tell all the listeners, if they want to contact you, if there is a parent out there that thinks that they have a daughter that's involved in sex trafficking, how would people find you out there?
Well, you can phone 1-250-299-3694. Email at my first name, which is Glenn D, GlenDene at doc.ca. SHAW.ca.
Okay.
Or just look up mothersagainsttraffickinghumans.com. MAS is an organization that I formed in 2010 that I use that as the platform that I go through for educating others on human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And the acronym is MAS. Do the MAS is millions of people missing and a lot of people getting rich and not the missing.
Yeah. And then, you have on Facebook as well. You're on Facebook.
That's right. So just Google Missing Jesse Foster to find Jesse's page or Glendene Grant to find my profile because I do a lot of postings from both. And then, of course, you know, everybody who's put in is YouTube. There's a lot of videos and things on our YouTube page, which is, again, under Jesse's mom, Glendene. Or just simply Google Jesse Foster and click on videos. And there's an e-entertainment document. There's a... The Jesse Foster, The Vanishing Point documentary. It's an entire website, actually, that was done by Mount Royal University journalism students. It actually won first prize down in Austin, Texas last year for a journalism award. And there's plenty more. I mean, there's Hope in the City video that Salvation Army did when I was the Hope Giver that year, because Hope Giver is someone who once had no hope and is now giving hope to others. And then there's, you know, videos that were just done by, you know, like Traffic Jam Canada and lots of news articles.
All right, Glendene, I appreciate you joining me on Unfound. And I'm going to link to all of that, all of those locations when this is posted. And I hope we can keep in touch in the future.
Certainly, definitely will.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Glendene. Thank you for joining me on Unfound. And that completed my interview with Glendene Grant. If you don't know how I do those interviews, I simply talk to the other person on the phone, my cell phone, and the cell phone records it, and then I send the file to my computer. She made a lot of points. We covered a lot of ground in that interview. And there's just a few sections that I'd like to point out before I complete this show. Just some observations, a couple things that are clear to me now. First of all, you have to understand something that we didn't really talk about in the interview, is that the belief that Glendene has is that Donald Voss sold Jesse to Peter Todd. Whether it was for money or for drugs or something like that, that's what Glendene believes. That did not come out in the interview, but in a prior conversation I had with her, that's what she said, and just didn't get to it in the interview. It's also obvious to me that before that, when they were in New York City and Donald Voss had said to Jesse, how about you turn a couple tricks so we can make a couple bucks while we're here? It's clear to me now that that was a test. That he was seeing how she would react if he said something like this. You have to remember that in Donald Voss' case, this was not his first venture into sex trafficking. So he knew what he was doing. And these men who do this, they're not any different than adults who prey on children, who sexually prey on children. There is a period of grooming. In fact, I did an interview recently where that was a large part of the interview that you will hear on a future episode of Unfound. It's the same thing here, testing boundaries, seeing what you can get away with, and seeing how the person reacts. And in this case, Jessie Foster, young woman, hard worker, nice girl, and in a short bit of time, they were able to take her from that to what she became, once again, by force. But that trip to New York City, I think, was the start of it. And when he saw that how she would react to it was just call some people, call her mother, call her sister, and tell all these people about what he said to her, but then still go back to him and then go with him to Las Vegas. I think that, unfortunately, Jessie was already on the path to where she ended up. Once again, her not even probably realizing it. I think another interesting point that was brought up is that, remember, she got to Las Vegas in May of 2005, and she was there no longer than a month, and she already had a broken jaw. And she was prostituting herself fairly quickly. This did not happen over the course of many months, where she arrived in May and then did not get her first, she didn't get caught until November or December. It was fairly quickly. Once again, this shows you the skill that, the horrible skills that men like this have. And you should also know that it is not unusual for these types of men to have women like Yvonne around them. Yvonne is, from what I can gather, a prostitute as well, but I don't think that she does it by force. She's actually a recruiter. I don't know technically what she's doing now in 2016, but at the time, she was a friend of Jesse's because she was helping to recruit Jessie and probably telling Jessie things that weren't true and turning, and it is a form of brainwashing. So that's not unusual for women who also are prostituting themselves. But they aren't there by force, they are there by choice. Whereas in Jessie's case, it's pretty clear that she didn't want to be there, but she was fearful for what might happen if she wasn't there. Just wanted to illustrate and highlight those points regarding all of this. As Glenn Dean Grant said in the interview, it seems, as far as she can tell, that Jessie was the last girl that Peter Todd trafficked. I think that what happened after Jessie disappeared is that he got a reputation, and it got a little harder after that to recruit other women. And so, like she said, he ended up getting into the trafficking of drugs. I don't know what he's doing now either. It should also be said that Jessie was not connected to these other prostitutes, because I can remember when I lived in Las Vegas that the Las Vegas media tried to connect the disappearance of Jessie with these three other women who were prostitutes that disappeared between 2002, 2003, and 2006. Glenn Dean believes that's a mistake. Actually, the women in those other stories of how they disappeared, and you should know in those cases, those are three other cases, those remains were found. Different situations. There's no proof that any of these women knew each other. And Although his name did not come up in the interview, I can tell you that Glenn Dean dismisses the idea that Jesse vanished, was made to disappear by Neil Falls, who is a known sexual predator and killer of prostitutes who lived, coincidentally, in Henderson between 2000 and 2008. Police do suspect that he might have something to do with the murders of a couple other of those prostitutes that are usually lumped in with Jesse. I have to tell you during the interview that I got chills when Glenn Dean talked about the newspaper and the picture being on the front of it. I remember that. I lived in Las Vegas when that happened. I remember it. And I remember all the stories that were done between 2006 and then when I left Las Vegas in 2011. And I can tell you, I never thought that all these years later that I would be talking to the mother of one of those women. It's just a little weird how life works out. So we come to the most important question. How is this case going to get solved? That's hard to say. And it should be known, as Glenn Dean talked about, she believes that Jesse did not die March 28th, March 29th. She believes that Jesse was trafficked away from Las Vegas because of her maybe thinking about leaving or something like that. And she ended up somewhere else and they just took all of her phones away from her and made it impossible for her to continue to contact anybody. I will admit I'm not so sure about that. If you're going to tell me that the police went into Peter Todd's house and did the luminol and everything else and found nothing, then I guess I would have to be open to the idea that she was sent out of Las Vegas alive. I can't stand here and tell you that, though. Okay? Of course, it would not be unusual for that to happen. The way I think that this is going to get solved, you have to remember that this Yvonne girl, and probably some other women that weren't even mentioned. We did mention Trish Vannersdell, who was the wife of Peter Todd. In Yvonne's case, she was like about Jesse's age, not much older than Jesse. So even now, 10 years later, Yvonne is only in her early 30s. And maybe some other women who were in that crowd are also still fairly young. I'm 46, so they're at least probably 10 years younger than I am. And I think what you have to hope is that one of these women eventually grow up. That one day that they wake up and try to make something in their lives outside of breaking the law and are willing to come forward and talk about the real Peter Todd. The real Donald Voss. Just have to hope that somebody in that crowd from that time cleans their act up and can go to the police. I don't know how otherwise this case is going to get resolved. I will tell you that just recently, I had an interview with a girl, a case I'm thinking about doing for the show, and I will be honest with you, she's afraid of going on the record at this time. But she talked about how back in her younger days that she was a hellraiser and doing drugs, doing this, stealing from men on purpose, and now all these years later, she doesn't do that anymore, and she's cleaned her act up. That's what I'm talking about. Because I don't see Peter Todd or Donald Voss or Peter Todd's twin brother, and that whole thing with the Clark County School District is embarrassing. It's horrible, embarrassing. I don't see any of those guys coming forward and admitting anything. But we'll continue to keep this in the news. You do a show like this, Nothing ever disappears on the internet. And so maybe one of these days we can bring Jesse home. I thank you for listening to this episode. You can find me on Twitter, Unfound Podcast. You can find this show on Podomatic, iTunes, and Stitcher. I'd love for you to subscribe. I'd love for you to give me a decent review. I'm Ed Denzel, and you've been listening to Unfound.